Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jeremy Sherlick, senior producer of The President's Inbox. We've got an exciting new offer for you from Foreign Affairs Magazine. Published by us, the Council on Foreign Relations, since 1922, Foreign Affairs Magazine puts what's going on in the world today into perspective. Featuring analysis and insights from internationally renowned experts, Foreign Affairs is a must-read. And today, we have an exclusive, discounted, one-year subscription offer just for our podcast listeners. To receive 70% off the original cover price of Foreign Affairs, go to foreignaffairs.com/presidentsinbox and enter the promo code INBOX19. Once again, that's foreignaffairs.com/presidentsinbox and enter the promo code INBOX19. And now on to the show.
Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast about the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. This week's topic is Ukraine. With me this week to discuss U.S. policy toward Ukraine is Ambassador Steven Sestanovich. Steve is the George F. Kennan Senior Fellow for Russian and Eurasian Studies at the Council, and he's also a professor of international diplomacy at Columbia University's School of International and Public Affairs. From 1997 to 2001, Steve was the U.S. Ambassador at Large for the former Soviet states. He has also worked on the staff of the National Security Council, in the State Department's Policy Planning Office, and on Capitol Hill. He is the author of the terrific book, Maximalist, America in the World from Truman to Obama. Steve, thanks for joining me.
Pleasure.
Steve, Ukraine is in the news these days, and I'd like you to sort of do a table setter, scene setter for us about the nature of U.S. relations with Ukraine. Obviously, Ukraine gets its independence after the collapse of the Soviet Union. What is the overall sort of contours of U.S. policy toward Ukraine been?
Well, let's start with Ukraine itself. You know, people sometimes say to me, why is there so much attention paid to this unimportant little country?
It's an unimportant country with about 44 million people,
in
right?
In reality, Ukraine is the territorially biggest country in Europe. As you say, it's got 45 million people, which puts it in the top tier of European states. It included within its boundaries important parts of the old Soviet military-industrial complex and some sophisticated parts, rocket launching. When we had to persuade the Ukrainians to curtail their work with the Iranians and the nuclear Bushehr reactor, it was because they had a sophisticated industry there. They also are an agricultural center that, you know, people don't know that Ukraine is one of the world's biggest grain exporters. And its very richness is, in fact, one of the reasons that I think it's been so controversial to define its direction. There are too many people who have a stake in how things have turned out. And the big questions, and these have been very much on the minds of American policymakers now for almost 30 years, are these. Is Ukraine going to lean east or west? And that means in its international dealings, but also in the composition of its internal affairs. Is it going to be an oligarchic state, or is it going to find progress toward the rule of law? And there have been an awful lot of people who had a stake in the answer and who wanted to prevent an answer that would comport with American interests.
So draw a comparison for me, because obviously if we look at the former Baltic countries, Baltic countries, they're part of the Soviet Union. They clearly have leaned toward the West, all members of NATO. Why is it that we're now 30 years past the collapse of the Soviet Union and we're still debating which way Ukraine will go?
Partly it's the scale of Ukraine, its location, its historical connection to Russia.
Can you explain that?
Russia will say, you know, as Putin himself often does, Ukraine is not a real country. We're the same people. And the idea that Russia and Ukraine should be separate doesn't sit well with a lot of Russians. And there are a lot of Russian speakers in Ukraine. There are a lot of Orthodox Christians. There are a lot of people who would identify themselves as Russians.
So there are two societies that are clearly intermingled.
The cultural and linguistic divisions within Ukraine have been commented on, have been lurking within Ukrainian politics for decades. I think people have actually often not given the Ukrainians enough credit for how well they've handled those. They've had the presidency go back and forth between people from the Russian East and the more Catholic Polish-leaning West without, you know, major crises, without the country at risk of breaking up. But their ability actually to fudge the answers to all of these questions, you know, is it going to be an oligarchic society or have the rule of law? Is it going to lean East or West? Their ability to fudge those and defer answers has actually been part of why Ukraine hasn't progressed as much as it might have and as some of its neighbors have.
So one of the big developments obviously comes in 2014 when the Russians annex Crimea, which had been part of Ukraine, I guess, since 1954, previously part of Russia. But also we have Ukrainian separatists in the eastern Russian-dominated portion of the country launch military operations.
Yeah, I don't want that to be the definition of 2014 because it represented something more important for all of Ukraine's development. It was supposed to be a kind of decisive answer on both of the questions that I've given, internal governance and international alignment.
So I jumped ahead of the story.
You jumped ahead of the story. Okay. In this sense, the big event in early 2014 was the Maidan uprising, which was to protest the seeming commitment of the then president Yanukovych to go with Putin, to repudiate a special connection to the EU, join up with Putin's Eurasian Economic Union, and to move away from the West. When Yanukovych was deposed after some violent episodes, confrontations in which the police shot protesters, the thought was that Ukraine had in fact made a commitment to lean West and to lean toward reform, that you were going to have a breakthrough on the corruption front and that Ukraine could somehow be integrated into, especially into the EU. Precisely for the reasons that I mentioned earlier, that is Ukraine's wealth, its geopolitical significance, you were bound to have a lot of pushback. The episodes that you mentioned, the annexation of Crimea and the starting of the war in eastern Ukraine, represented the Russians' pushback. That was a major international crisis. It produced a major response from the EU and from NATO. But there was also pushback internally. Oligarchs regrouping, trying to find ways of preserving their ill-gotten gains and their access to power. And 5 years later, people look around and wonder, well, you know, what have we gotten out of this? There was a clear determination reflected in poll results before this year's elections that the people just did not want the same leadership again. They didn't like the results that they'd gotten out 5 years after the Maidan. And so they said, we're going with something really new. They overwhelmingly chose a new president who'd never been in office before and whom they expected to make a major push, because this is what he said he would do, to end the war and to push forward reform and crack down on corruption.
Let's just back up a second. Let's talk about the last president, Mr. Poroshenko, also known, I believe, as the Chocolate King. I believe one of the Ukrainians.
Because he made a lot of money in candy.
Okay. The Candy King, Chocolate King. Why is it that the promise many people saw when he was elected didn't come to bear?
Well, that is really a hard question.
Okay.
and every Ukrainian might give you a different
but
answer.
But what is sort of
the
sense of
the
why
big,
he failed?
Here are the big things. Ukraine had chosen in Poroshenko, who latched on to the Maidan demonstrations early and it supported them. They'd still chosen a president who was from the old political class, who was a billionaire oligarch himself, And it turned out to be a lot harder for him to maneuver among oligarchs and to see his own interest in comprehensive reform. Secondly, Ukrainians had not chosen a really unified leadership. They put a lot of reformers around Poroshenko and supported a lot of reformist parties, but all of them divided amongst themselves. So you had a lot of the same micro groupings, personality-driven parties, special agendas, corrupt interests that you'd had before with no clear challenger to Poroshenko and to oligarchic interests. Those are probably the main reasons for the internal political stalemate in Ukraine. But you also had the fact that you had an ongoing war in the eastern part of the country, a confusion about how much the West was really going to be willing to do for Ukraine. And the result of that was that a lot of Ukrainian political leaders decided, we had our revolution, we don't have to do anything more. And I think that became Poroshenko's mindset.
So walk me through what was happening in Europe and in the United States during this time. Because again, I think outside interest had great hopes that Poroshenko would turn things around, Ukraine would finally tackle corruption.
Yeah.
There was certainly a lot of lofty speeches given in the capitals of Europe and in the United States about the importance of getting Ukraine right. So what was the approach the United States and its friends and allies took?
Well, I think you have to give the United States and Europe a lot of credit for the way in which they reinvigorated their political and strategic cooperation after the Ukraine crisis. I would say was in the second Obama term, arguably the most significant success of his policy. The approach was to try to provide for Ukraine's security by offering cooperation, gradually building up its ability to defend itself, military training and equipment. The European Union and the United States imposed a broad set of sanctions against Russia to try to make clear that this was absolutely unacceptable behavior and that they would have Ukraine's back as long as Russia did not back down from its own annexations and support of the war. And there was a lot of support for significant packages of assistance from the IMF and the World Bank. And that was all very conditional. The idea was, unless Ukraine moved forward on reform of the energy industry, on the banking system, on local government, on a whole host of issues, judicial reform, that support from the West would be cut off. And there were many occasions where the IMF held up aid because they weren't satisfied with progress on corruption.
So where did we end up at the end of the Obama administration on this score in terms of Western policy toward Ukraine, and particularly the idea about providing lethal military aid to the Ukrainians? That was obviously a big issue during the Obama presidency.
That was an issue on which the Obama administration was quite divided. There were many people who wanted to offer a more robust package of security assistance, including lethal weapons. The key item that the Ukrainians wanted and that people at the Pentagon thought that they needed was anti-tank weapons. The Obama administration thought that it was better not to provoke the Russians at a time where they weren't sure how the Russians would react.
They were worried about escalation.
They were fearful that there would be a new eruption of hostilities and the Russians would have openings that would allow them to take larger portions of Ukraine. So it was a calculated decision not to take a risk. A lot of people thought that was the wrong message, that you wanted to show the Russians that there couldn't be any benefit for them in escalating. The Trump administration resolved that early on in 2017, indicated that they would, in fact, move toward lethal assistance.
So this was driven by the Trump administration rather than by Congress.
There was a lot of support in Congress, but it surely helped that people could say to the president, this was something President Obama was too timid to do, the kind of argument that seems always to carry the day with President Trump.
Okay, so do you think that is what was sort of driving the White House calculation? Because again, typical criticism of President Trump is that he's too deferential to President Putin. And here we have an administration providing lethal military aid to the Ukrainians so they can fight against, at a minimum, Russian-sponsored forces.
I think it's a real example of how divided the Trump administration has been. You had people in the Pentagon and the State Department who thought there was no good way to get an improved relationship with the Russians unless it was absolutely clear that we were standing behind Ukraine. The president had his own ideas, I guess, about how to develop a relationship with Putin. It moved kind of slowly, and he may have been persuaded that somehow these two things could go together, as I think they arguably could. But my instinct is that the thing that probably made it easiest for him to accept it is this was an Obama policy that he could overturn.
So are you suggesting that people in the administration, the government, who had lost the argument when President Obama was in office, had an opportunity with President Trump to, in essence, re-up the argument and fight it again?
They weren't necessarily the same people, but they reflected
the same conviction. But certainly in the U.S. military, in the State Department.
In the Pentagon and in the State Department, and probably—
Certainly on Capitol Hill, I think.
Absolutely on Capitol Hill. Capitol Hill has been a center of support for Ukraine for the past 5 years, okay. Arguably for the past 25 years.
Okay. So now we have this aid package that's supposed to go into effect, I guess, sometime in the spring. It has been held up. That's a matter of debate as to why it was held up. I'm just curious, Steve, because in sort of looking at it, sort of the U.S. policy toward Ukraine in many ways is odd because we had an ambassador who was brought home. The president's been quoted in news stories as not saying positive things about her. But we also have a special envoy to Ukraine, Kurt Volker, who held that position until recently when he stepped down. And I will note he was doing it on a pro bono basis because he actually had left the State Department. How typical is it for administrations to have that kind of overlapping State Department diplomatic representation?
You got to recognize that the State Department and ambassadorial posts abroad have for a long time been staffed by people with diverse backgrounds, political appointees, people with overlapping jurisdictions. That's not so new. But what seems to be very unusual here is the way in which people in those roles have stepped out of them and operated on the basis of kind of direct interaction with the president or the president's informal advisors. You know, if you're a political appointee ambassador in Europe, you've typically contributed a lot to the campaign, but you play by the rules. Your number two tells you what to do, gives you
usually
your
DCM.
Yeah, the DCM gives you your talking
points. Deputy Chief of Mission.
When you go to the foreign ministry, you do what he or she says, and you enjoy your sumptuous residence, and then after 2 or 3 years, you go home. You don't expand your portfolio. You don't go to other countries and try to make trouble. You generally are very aware of your lane. What's interesting in the case of Ambassador Sondland, who was the ambassador to the EU and who got very involved in Ukraine policy, is
and,
that—
And Ukraine is not part of the EU.
Absolutely not part of his portfolio.
So entirely separate lane, maybe even in a different building.
Yeah. Probably the only thing you could say is that, well, the EU has been the main force behind a lot of sanctions right. against Russia. But this is a case where his ability to expand his portfolio seems to have depended entirely on deciding that there was something who especially pleased the president and where he could advance his own interests, his own prominence, maybe get another job in government on the basis of doing the president a favor. The same is true for the special envoy. Typically, special envoys have a slightly uneasy relationship with the bureaus they're part of, but they work it out. They divide up the labor and—
Because they're seen as interlopers by sort of people who hold traditional positions.
Absolutely. I'll take an example. In the 90s, there was often a special envoy for the Balkans who had to work with the Assistant Secretary for Europe, who often had kind of contrary interests and policy preferences, and you know, they had to work it out. But I don't know of a case where the special envoy for the Balkans thought he could, you know, start informally communicating with the president about his ability to do him a personal favor. So that picture that you have of how Ukrainian policy was conducted is unusually chaotic.
One other question I want to ask you about sort of the mechanics of this, given your experience, is how typical is it for ambassadors or any other diplomatic representative of the United States to get into negotiations with foreign heads of states about meeting with the president or getting to visit the United States? Is that sort of typical?
Jim, visiting the president, having a meeting in the Oval Office, this is one of the prizes of international relations. And an ambassador who can arrange for the president of the country to which he's accredited to visit Washington, the ambassador will normally get to visit along at the same time, that's a big success. That is, it shows his ability to deliver the goods for the host government. And that kind of orchestration is common. It is, in this case, different, however, because what was being used as the lure, the leverage, the issues that had to be resolved before you get that prize meeting in the Oval Office involved domestic politics and was being negotiated, as I said, by people who were not the host ambassador. All the characters in this, you know, the closest you have to real ambassadors are the chargé in Kiev, who's the acting ambassador, and he's sort of challenging what all these other interlopers are doing. The people who are negotiating the visit to the Oval Office are themselves not ordinarily the people who would be doing that.
Right. Okay. So in this situation then, negotiating over a visit by a head of state, perfectly normal. What's unusual here is who's doing the negotiating and what they're offering up or demanding in exchange for arranging that meeting.
Absolutely. Typically, when you're organizing a meeting of this sort, the issues that are involved and, you know, are scheduling, of course.
Yep.
When is the president free? But also, can you come up with a deliverable, common U.S. government term, for the result of a meeting? Can you show a breakthrough in policy discussions that have been going on for a long time and use the meeting as a lever to get some progress? And that will be in reference to the standard agenda. What was interesting about the deliverable in this case was that it was something that had not been part of the traditional agenda of U.S.-Ukrainian relations, but represented a special personal interest of the president.
Yeah, and this is a very fluid story.
Yeah.
Perhaps by the time this comes out, news will have broken on the domestic front about how this is unfolding. I don't want to get into the issue of how the impeachment inquiry is going to go. I'd actually like to focus on a different issue with you, which is the consequences for U.S. policy, either in the region with Ukraine.
Yeah.
Or other countries in the region, or more broadly, given that this issue has come to the forefront. We have an impeachment inquiry that is built around, at its core, the idea that the president was trying to get the Ukrainians to deliver him a domestic political favor. And, you know, you've seen a lot during your career. How do you assess the consequences of this sort of new chapter that we have entered in politics here at home, which obviously have consequences for us abroad?
Yeah. Look, what we've seen here has shocked people around the world, but I wouldn't say that it has given them a completely new picture of how this administration operates. And let me give you three examples. Putin, Macron, and Zelensky himself, the president of Ukraine. I was in Russia a week ago, and what I heard from Russians is this scandal does not change anything for us. We know that the president is not somebody that we have any hope of really doing serious business with. We can't understand what they're trying to do. We hear all of these positive things about his interest in a good relationship with Putin, but we see no results and we don't expect any results. For them, this is just confirmation of the chaos of American politics. They've written off the relationship as a victim of American domestic politics. Look at Macron. Macron has been taking the lead in trying to develop a restart, a negotiating track between the Russians and the Ukrainians. And the American view of this has been extremely confused, incoherent. Are we going to be involved? Are we not? What are we signaling to the Russians? What are we signaling to the Ukrainians? Macron figures, on the basis of his previous contacts with President Trump, surely figures that if he's going to make any headway on this, it's got to be just a European initiative. President Zelensky, what has he learned from this? Actually, what he's learned, I think, is if you stall, if you don't play ball with the Americans, you actually come out ahead.
Really?
Yeah. He, again and again, in the course of this episode, refused to do what the Trump people were telling him he had to do in order to get a meeting. They didn't deliver the language about what was going to be investigated. They have basically stalled, and they have found themselves, as a result, able to say, look, we couldn't do this.
Now, why do you think they took that strategy rather than giving the administration what it asked for?
Because I think they knew when what they said to President Trump's representatives is, it is really a bad business for us to get involved in American domestic politics. They said, we just don't want to do that. You're asking us to go over a line here, and that will jeopardize the bipartisan support that we've had in the Congress, which we talked about earlier. So I think they
knew. So it's self-interest.
They knew, absolutely. They knew they were being led into something extremely dangerous, and they thought, better not to do business. So take Putin, take Macron, take Zelensky. All three actually seem to be concluding better to stay away from actually trying to negotiate any significant advance with the Americans, because the Americans are too unpredictable. The administration is trying to do things too exclusively related to domestic politics, and the result can be too dangerous and damaging for them. And I think the result is, you know, people are looking to see what will happen after 2020.
I'm struck that you use the word unpredictable, and you use it to suggest that from the vantage point of Moscow, from Kiev, from Paris, American unpredictability is a reason not to work with the United States or not to expect much from the United States. But obviously for President Trump, being unpredictable is not a vice, it's a virtue.
Predictability is generally treated by diplomats as a virtue, because when you promise something that the other side knows you'll deliver, if you threaten something, they have to worry that you'll really go through with it. President Trump's unpredictability means that people who are threatened can think, oh, okay, maybe he won't deliver. It also means, though, that people who are promised something can't be sure that they'll get it. So the result is, cross to the other side of the street when you see the guy coming.
So where do you think we're headed specifically on the issue of the future of Ukraine, where there is still violence in the east, where the Russian separatists are operating? There's been some talk about having new negotiations between Kiev and Moscow, depending on who's going to be involved in that. Do you have some optimism that perhaps a deal will be worked out? Are you skeptical, thinking that because people aren't confident in the administration having a consistent policy, that we're just going to sort of be stuck in the current situation? Or are you worried that all of those ingredients could actually lead us into more conflict?
Well, let me give you the positive case. The president has been maneuvered into reaffirming, restarting American security assistance to Ukraine. He's got no choice but to continue that. He has got an administration that is surely now more obliged to help Ukraine economically, support an IMF package if there's one that the IMF itself can support. And that's actually up in the air. The IMF has deferred its assistance to Ukraine, but the United States is not going to be able to stand in the way. So the core elements of Western support for Ukraine, military and economic, those I think are actually beyond the reach of the president at this point, and he is going to have to go forward with those. And the Ukrainian government can count on that kind of support without the president interfering. Where they need kind of day-to-day involvement from the United States, clear messages about what kinds of compromises they'll support between Russia and Ukraine, there I think it's much less certain that the United States can play a constructive role. But the United States had been kind of marginalized even before this scandal erupted, and I think that will probably continue.
On that note, I am going to close up the President's Inbox for this week. My guest has been Ambassador Steve Sestanovich. He was the U.S. Ambassador at Large to the former Soviet states from 1997 to 2001. He is the author of the book Maximalist, America and the World from Truman to Obama. And he also has a piece on CFR.org this week entitled, Is Russia Winning the Ukraine Scandal? Steve, thanks for joining me.
Pleasure, Jim.
Please subscribe to the President's Inbox on Apple Podcasts. Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And leave us a review. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Opinions expressed in the President's Inbox are solely those of the host or guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions. Today's episode was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlick. Charles Tolbert was our recording engineer. Special thanks to Margaret Gatch for her assistance. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening.